This call is now being recorded.
Good. I tell you. They say that we're in the age of communications, right? All we do is punch numbers and punch numbers with our fingers crossed, right?
Right, exactly.
Pretty crazy. Ruth, I'm so glad to interview you, and I'm really, really glad to be back in touch with you again. I was going to say that really, you and I should just probably have, you should come over for lunch someday and let me update you on some things that have happened since I last talked with you, because it's pretty serious stuff, and I think, I really seriously think that I was biting off so much when we really started the project that West Virginians almost couldn't really think that we were going to be a model for the country, or, you know, just be a model.
Yes, but we.
And I think people are beginning to realize that now, and I'm extremely relieved at it, really.
I think so, too.
Anyway, let me get on now. What we're going to do here is we'll just go through a pretty typical interview, but you interrupt me at any time, and you talk about anything that comes to your mind. I think so much of you telling me about your husband at the Baton March, I also think about you telling me about Charles Yeager sitting and staring out the window in high school. He was, you know, his mind was someplace else.
He was dreaming about flying that airplane.
I guess he was. Well, the funny thing, and I never told you at the time, was we had, I don't remember the game, but you pretend like you're somebody else and you go through the motions and somebody has to guess who you are or what you're, you know, it's like pantomime in a way.
Uh-huh.
And one of the girls in my class just pulled up a chair and sat and stared out the window. And finally somebody said, oh, that's Ann Frazier. And everybody said, yeah, that's Ann Frazier. And I didn't realize that I sat and stared out the window the whole time. So when you told me about Charles Yeager, I thought, well, if I could only be as rich and famous as he is, you know, but that's what I did. I did that through high school, too. Our minds were someplace else, dreaming,
right.
I guess. I don't know. Anyway, when we interview you here, you just basically talk about anything whatsoever. Now, do realize that we have a pet organization, which is a museum in the Netherlands, and we'd love for you to go over there sometime. That it's a museum called the National Liberation Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, we were guests over there with Three Rosies last year. And they did an incredible job. And the most important thing is that the Rosies who went realized for the very first time who these people were that we liberated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we have an extreme fondness for this particular museum. Although we also have, you know, great, great pride in many museums. So we have a list of about 15 libraries and museums. So when we do finish up this small project of 10 interviews, we're going to be sending these copies or these transcripts and your voice over to about 15 or so museums.
Oh, that'll be
and that's the use of this particular one. And at some point I'll drop a new release form in the mail to you for you to sign and send back so that we can give this over to the libraries and they can use it however they want, and that'll be in the United States and probably only in Europe. But, you know, if Asians wanted it or other parts of the world, we'd definitely give them away.
That's right.
So that's what it's all about. So, okay, ready, set, go. Really simple questions first. What was your name when you were born, and when were you born?
Okay, I was born in Hamelin, West Virginia. That's in Lincoln County. And my name was Ruth Anna Adkins at that time. And I graduated from high school in 1941. And at that time, everybody was talking about the war. And practically every one of our young men enlisted in the service, and the girls all went to work. Not one single one went to college, because they put that on hold. And,
okay,
you know, I've often said my claim to fame was having graduated with highly decorated Brigadier General Chuck Yeager. But I've decided, you know, I did okay on my own, too.
You did okay on your own. You definitely did. You really did. Well, now, let's see. Is Ruth Anna, A-N-N-A?
Yes, uh-huh.
Ruth Anna. Oh, my goodness. I think we have five Annas all at once.
Is
we didn't have
right?
an Anna last year. Now we've got, I think you're the fifth one. I'm not sure. Something like that.
I always went with the name of Ruth.
And so now, the Adkins family, you know, there were a lot of Adkins when I grew up in Huntington.
Uh-huh.
We always thought they had, that most of them had red hair. Did you all have a lot of redheads in your family?
No. My dad said we all came from Kentucky. He says we were from a different group.
Oh, really?
So I don't know. I didn't know much about my family on my dad's side.
Is that right?
Uh-huh.
Really? Well, tell me a little bit about your childhood. I know Hamlin pretty well because Mother grew up there. So tell me about your own family. How many brothers and sisters and all that?
I was an only child.
Really?
Yes. And
you don't act like an only child. I thought you were the oldest of about 10.
No,
and
no, no.
You're so responsible.
And my mother remarried. She married the second time, who was a former, he was a state senator from Lincoln County, and his name was Calvin Hall. And so I grew up in his home, and he was a wonderful stepdad.
And now, did you lose your real father, or what happened?
I lost him.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. And I graduated from high school. I was valedictorian, and didn't go on to college, of course, because that was everybody was talking about the war.
Yeah, so for sure.
Most of the young girls got jobs, and I was one of them. But I had a wonderful childhood. I mean, it was very, very nice. And but I think I got a good education. And then I got
there's Hamlin and West Hamlin. Where are you from? Hamlin?
From Hamlin. Yeah. That was the county seat of Lincoln County.
Yeah. Right. That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me this. Now, when you graduated from high school in 1941. Obviously, the war had just been underway by, what are we talking about? The war was underway.
We're talking about the war in Europe.
And yeah.
It was before the bomb, you know, it was before Japan attacked Pearl Harbor.
Right. So, in other words, when you graduated in May of 1941, we were supplying Europe,
yes,
and with supplies. And I also think that there were many, many American soldiers who were in the Pacific, but we were not. Essentially, we had not declared war.
That's right.
We were supporting the war effort, but we weren't declared.
That's
so,
right.
So you're saying that when you graduated from high school, even before Pearl Harbor, your boys went down and joined up?
Yes. Now, the boy that I was dating at that time enlisted, you know, in peacetime.
Mm-hmm.
He enlisted in April of 1941, and,
uh-huh.
and Japan attack on December 7th of 1941. So he was already over there. He was in the Philippines at the time the bomb was at the time they bombed Pearl Harbor.
Right. You know, I think of all the interviews I've done, Ruth, I swear I don't know of any whole class. I only know of incidental individuals who went into the service before Pearl Harbor. I really did not know. That sure shows West Virginians are patriotic, doesn't it?
Patriotic. And Lincoln County especially, a young man wrote a book about Lincoln County veterans, and it's really interesting because it shows how many from Lincoln County really got involved in the war.
And now, what do you know the name of that book?
It's Lincoln County Veterans, I believe. I have a copy of it here.
Oh, I'd love it. And do you know his
very,
name?
Very good.
Do you know his name?
His name was Bob Vandelin.
V-A-N?
V-A-N-D-E-L-I-N-D-E.
Oh, my goodness. How about that?
And
really? This is all fascinating to me because I was born in 1939, but I was born in Huntington. My mother left Hamlin when she was a preteen. And then I was born in Huntington. Oh, my goodness. This is all very fascinating
Hamlin
to me.
Hamlin was a nice town.
Yeah.
There weren't any manufacturing plants or anything. Most people worked for the county and, you know, or just local places, but there were no manufacturing plants or anything there. They sort of called it a bedroom town because you worked out of there and then you came back. But it
right.
was a good place to grow up. Small town.
Right. Well, now tell me then when you graduated, what did you do as soon as you graduated?
I got me a job. I got a job at Carnegie and Carnegie, Illinois Steel. It was located in the Naval Ordnance Plant here in South Charleston.
Uh-huh.
And South Charleston was a booming town at that time.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah, for sure.
Troop trains were passing through and sirens were sounding and restaurants and other places of business were busy, busy, busy.
Hmm. Well, now, the name of the place that you got a job is Carnegie Steel?
Yes, Carnegie, Illinois Steel Corporation.
Carnegie, Illinois Steel.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
It was out of Pennsylvania.
And now when you worked over there, it's what now is a stamping plant.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm.
I actually had thought that particular building where the Today Show taped us, that's where you worked, right? That's exactly where you worked?
Mm-hmm. That was where we had that show was in the machine. Well, we called the machine shop. That's where they had their drill presses and their milling machines and all the machines that made those heavy steel parts for the battleships.
You know, it was very strange to me when the Today Show called and they wanted to know whether or not we would be an organization they could work with to find the Rosies. And I put the American Rosie the Riveter Association on the line, and the producer up there in New York, I can't remember her name right now, she said, I have to ask two questions. Number one, can you find a bona fide World War II plant where nothing has been changed? And number two, can you get 50 women there? Actually, she wanted more than 50 at first. And I picked up my cell phone and called Bob Anderson over there at the at the Convention Visitors Bureau. And I said, call me back in 14 minutes. That's all you got, Bob. And you tell me whether or not there's a room in that whole big stamping plant that's never been changed. He said there is, and it's essentially rented out by American Electric Power. And I said, well, find out if they'll let us in. And he called me back, and as soon as I told her that, she wanted to film it here. So I'm real pleased it was filmed there. It's really too bad that they let go of Ann Curry and then they didn't promote the curtain.
Oh, that was too bad.
It was really too bad because I put 6 whole months into that. Yeah, really. Mm-hmm. We had 50 women there that day.
Yeah.
Well, now, I've been in that location, and I am very impressed that it was just a big, open space. Somehow or another, when I think of factories, I think of them as being kind of like segmented, you know, maybe 20 small rooms, like making one thing in one room and one in another. But it wasn't that way. It's almost like a humongous warehouse.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So tell me what you thought about when you first walked in there and what did you do? Just talk about your work.
Well, as a young person right out of high school, I was amazed at all that.
Yeah.
I was employed as an expediter in the machine shop, and that's where we make gun barrels and other parts for battleships. And the huge area was filled with huge drill presses and milling machines and a lot of other machines that were all noisy. So I was really impressed by all that noise. But my main duties consisted of checking with each machine operator to make sure that they had what they needed for that shift and relaying that information to the main office. And, you know, back at that time, there were no smartphones for management to communicate with the workers. So
yeah.
That's what we did. And we often called ourselves runners because that's what we did. And if we'd had Fitbits back then, I'm sure we'd have gotten our 10,000 steps on every shift. Getting used to the noise was a big problem for me. Because
right.
the big cranes, the overhead running, and they were clanging their bells and everything to make sure that everybody got out of the way. And we work shift work, 8 to 12, and 4 to 12 the next, and 12 to 8 the next.
Okay, now you cut out just a little bit. Your shifts were 8 to what? Start
eight
that
to
again.
4, 8 to 4, 4 one week, and 4
uh-huh.
to 12 the next, and 12 to 8 the next.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, and so each week you had a different schedule.
Yes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
And that was hard to get used to because it messed up your sleeping routine.
Oh, yeah. See, when I put my ex-husband through to PhD, I worked a split shift and night shift and gosh knows whatever. And I really had a hard time adapting to it. I still don't do well. I can't stay up. I can get up in the middle of night and work, but I can't do that night shift anymore. I can't do it. Tell me this. Now, when I walked into that room and we just had a brief amount of time there before they set up with the Today Show, I was extremely impressed that the very pieces of equipment that they had used were still there 70 years later, just laying there.
That's right.
When the work came to an end, they just dropped everything and
dropped
left,
everything.
And nobody ever even came up and cleaned it up? Is
dropped
that right?
Dropped everything and just left. I mean, it was when war was over, the plant shut down right then.
Is that right? Now, another thing I've been confused about is I thought that was called General Machinery over there.
No. General Machinery was another section.
Uh-huh. Where was that?
It was a part of that big plant there. That Naval Ordnance Plant housed General Machinery, was in one section. That building was a lot larger than it is now. It had changed some. General Machinery was there, and the Naval Ordnance Plant, there were three separate divisions, and Carnegie Illinois Steel was a separate one.
Is that right?
Uh-huh.
So now, see, I never understood it. So there were three divisions, and one that was Carnegie. And one was General Machinery. What was the other one?
The U.S. Naval Ordnance Plant. Naval Ordnance Plant.
And so they called the whole place a U.S. Naval Ordnance Plant, but it wasn't.
Yes, referred to right, yes.
Oh, my goodness. Well, what did each of these do that was different? In other words, what did General Machinery do that Carnegie did not do?
Now, I don't know, but I know we did battleships.
Yes.
We were mostly with the Navy. And I don't know about General Machinery. It was a lot of the same type of work.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not know, you know, this is really, I couldn't exactly tell you about the different jobs. I knew friends that worked there, and they did practically the same thing. But the ones that I knew were mostly in the office.
Mm-hmm.
They did that just routine office work. But, you know, of course, that goes along with any job.
Right.
But they were involved with the making parts for airplanes and ships.
Well, now something that I always found kind of amusing. You're a particularly short lady. You're not, you know, you don't have a big sprint.
No.
Why would they choose you to be a runner or an expediter when probably they could have chosen somebody 5'7" who could do it faster? Is that a crazy question?
Not for me, honey, because I could move faster than most of them.
And I can believe that. I definitely believe that. So,
but we were the link of communication between the management and the workers.
Yeah.
And we picked up time cards. We checked their time cards. And I remember, and we all had badge numbers, of course. And
uh-huh.
I remember my number was 3572.
Is that right?
And I knew the number of most of my friends, you know, because you checked that to make sure that everybody was on the job.
Uh-huh.
The machines they were supposed to be working on. Of course, we didn't have any problems with that, but we had to check anyway.
Right. But
safety was a big thing, you know, when you checked in, when you checked in with your time card, you were checked. They knew exactly who you were and what your badge number was, and
mm-hmm.
everything was the way it was supposed to be.
How about that?
Safety was...
Well, now tell me, you would go from the office over to, let's say, the machine operator, the machine supervisor.
Yes.
And what did you do? What did you communicate? Tell us as much about it as you possibly can.
Well, you talked with the operator, and you made sure that he had the proper tools that he was supposed to have for that shift. And if he had any problems at all, anything that he needed, to communicate with management, then we would take that information back to the office, to the manager, and the night shift or the day shift, whichever shift manager it was, and tell him any problem that they might have, and it was, you know, he took care of it.
So now there weren't even internal phones. You're saying nobody could pick up a phone and call 9 and get the office. No internal phones.
No internal phones.
Oh, my goodness.
That's what we did. We were just, you know, the link of communications between operations and management.
Now, once you told somebody like your manager that there was a problem, that something broken or somebody needed a tool, you didn't deliver those tools. Somebody else did that.
We did if, you know, if it was something that we could. But if it was a major thing, then it was handled by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But we took the information back to the office.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned a boyfriend that you had in high school.
Yes.
And then he went into the military. Now, you had not met your husband at that time, or you met, you knew him, but not very well. What was that all about?
He became my husband. He's the one I married.
Oh, he is the one you married.
Yes.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
When you married your husband, you were still working? Were you married when you started working?
No, I was not married. He came home in October of 1945.
Uh-huh.
That's when he was liberated from the Japanese prison camp.
Uh-huh.
So he came home in October, and we were married shortly after that.
Huh. I bet you were shocked seeing him after he'd been really starved, I guess,
yes,
right?
Yes, he was starved. He went down 74 pounds at one time.
Hmm.
So
that must have been really hard for you.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I bet. I can imagine. What was his name exactly?
James Edwards. James H. Edwards. James Harold Edwards.
Now, where did... He was in what branch of the...
He was in the Air Force. He was in the Air Force in the Philippines, and then all their planes were bombed at Pearl Harbor. He had to fight with the regular army because, you know, their planes were gone. So he fought with the regular army. And then he was captured in April of 42.
Mm-hmm.
And was Japanese. Well, he was missing in action for a long time. And then when they finally heard from him, he was in prison camp.
And I bet the family thought he had...
Yeah, we all thought he was gone because he wasn't a very large man. He wasn't a big person to start with, so we didn't think he could make it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was,
so now, did he tell you very much about the Bataan March? How did he, when he got captured, that's when he was in the Bataan March?
Yes, right.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
When he was captured, he was on the Bataan Death March.
Mm-hmm.
And that lasted for days and days and days and miles and miles and miles. But it wasn't as far as it seemed because they marched them round and round. They didn't exactly know what to do with them. There were more of them than they expected.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really know what to do with them. So they marched them a lot farther than they needed to because they had to decide what to do with them, I guess.
Yeah.
So then after that, they put him in a prison camping place called Cabana Tawan, Camp Cabana Tawan. And I couldn't spell it for you.
I can't do it either, but anyway.
And then he went to several other camps, Camp O'Donnell. He was in Camp O'Donnell. And he was on the death ships where they didn't expect any of them to live, and an awful lot of them didn't because they were crowded in there and wasn't room to survive, really. And then they got to Japan, and he was in Japan the rest of the time in Tokyo. And that's where he was at the end of the war. And then they were he was liberated from there. He was really officially liberated because they didn't get to them. The guards, they found out they were liberated, but the war was over because the guards didn't show up. Mm-hmm. So they knew, but the guard's not showing up. You know, it was, something was going on. So they kind of liberated themselves, really.
So you're saying that they're in Tokyo and the war's over and the guards don't show up.
Mm-hmm.
And what do they do then? They go down to the harbor to get on a U.S. boat or what?
What my husband did, I don't know how he did it, but he managed to get to the Air Force, to the airport. And he explained to one of the pilots, one of the captains or whatever, what had happened and that they were liberated, and he flew him back to the Philippines.
Oh, my gosh. Honestly, Ruth, you know, I've always said to Jay Wirtz and others that you ladies, there's about three things on my mind. First of all, very often the American veterans won't talk about their experience, but they do tell their wives. And Buddy, you know, has many stories to tell about her husband waking up at night and having seizures and thinking, you know, I'm being in flashbacks and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I still say that the fact that nobody interviewed you all to find out from you what your husband's told you all, it's unbelievable to me, because I know that the men talk to you all.
Oh, I could write a book. My husband's doctor told him, first of all, he wouldn't talk about it. He didn't want to talk about it. And his doctor told him that he was going to have to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, if you don't find somebody to talk to, he said, I'm going to send you to somebody that you're going to have to talk to. And Jimmy said, well, I'll talk to my wife. So then he started to tell me things. And he had nightmares. I mean, he had nightmares all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And his health was never good. He had all kinds of problems.
That's really too bad, really too bad. So now, when you finally saw him, where did you see him again? Where were you all reunited? Did he get off a train in Charleston or South Charleston?
No, I was, at that time the war was over, Carnegie was closed, and I had gotten a job at Carbide. So
uh-huh.
My mother and I had moved from Hamlin up to Kenna Homes here in South Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up to Kenna Homes. And that's when I saw him. His
he just came and knocked on the door.
Well, he said his brother-in-law parked down at the... I was riding the bus because it was hard to get automobiles at that time, you know.
Yeah, right.
And I was riding a bus, so I got off the bus, and he said he saw me get off the bus. So he saw my feet and recognized me from my feet.
Oh, my goodness.
So then he came on down to the apartment.
I guess I still want to ask, what was it like seeing him when you hadn't seen him for 2.5 years?
Well, it was strange. It was very strange. He was very, he was so thin when he was liberated, and they kept him in a hospital in California, Letterman General Hospital in California, until they put a little bit of weight on them.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, when he came in, he was as heavy as he was when he left. He didn't look that different, except in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And his face and his eyes were, you know, I could tell by his eyes, because he had a different look.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the main difference, I think.
Honestly. Well, what can I say? My goodness. It sure is powerful, isn't it?
Oh, my.
Really powerful. So then you all got married. When did you get married?
We got married on the 16th of October.
So that was...
45.
So basically you got married very quickly after
your
return.
Very quickly.
Yeah.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. You know, I've got to tell another story. I think when you do interviews, you're not supposed to tell about other people, but I don't care. They can fire me when I'm dead, right? Whoever's listening to this 30 years from now. Neva Reese, she's more than 6 feet tall, and she was captain of her basketball team in Fairmont and grew up on a dairy farm and all that. Anyway, her boyfriend, her fiance, was in the Philippines, in the Pacific, in the jungle. And he was in a foxhole for 4 years, and he was also there before the war. And when they finally united after 4 years, he's in an airport waiting for her, and, you know, it's a crowded airport, and he recognized her by her legs. He just saw these legs coming toward her. So you got feet and she's got legs, but somehow or another, I think it's so interesting that that's how they recognized you all.
Uh-huh.
That's so interesting. Tells you a little bit about nonverbal behavior, and it ain't just the gorgeous body that makes the difference. There's something going on there, but I don't know what it is. Anyway, tell me then, now, you all had, did you immediately move into like an apartment in South Charleston or what?
Yes, we did. And he was in, after he came back, they sent him to, at that time, the Greenbrier in White Sulphur Springs.
Right.
Became a hospital. They turned that into a hospital
mm-hmm.
for veterans. And he was up there for about 8 months after he came home. And that was right after we were married. So he was up there, and then I would go back and forth on the train to visit him up there. And I could have stayed up there, and I did stay part of the time, but, of course, I couldn't stay in the Greenbrier. I got a little hotel down in White Sulphur Spring called, at that time it was the Alvon, A-L-V-O-N, Hotel. So I stayed at that little hotel, and then I went to the Greenbrier during the day and spent the day with him. And then,
well, now, you're saying that he was like, this was a place for him to recover, am I correct?
Right.
But what were his ailments? What, did he have actual physical?
He had a two or three lines on his discharge of things. He had beriberi. I can't think of all the illnesses now, and he had malaria, and it mm-hmm. was back ever so often, you know.
Right.
And I'd never heard of beriberi, but I found out what it was. And he had problems with his heart. And
uh-huh.
he had a whole list of ailments wrong when he came home.
Well, now, what is beriberi?
Well, it has to do with the blood. I mean, it's like malnutrition is what it is.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't have anything to eat, just a little cup of rice. A very small portion of rice. And at one time, they gave him up for dead and put him in what they called the death house.
Uh-huh.
And that was supposed to be like it wasn't like a hospital because they didn't treat you.
Uh-huh.
You were just there. And there was a young man that passed by the window of that death house and saw him, recognized him, and asked the Japanese officer, the Japanese guard, if they would let him take care of Jim Edwards, that he knew him and he would take care of him and they wouldn't have to bother with him.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't being fed or anything, so this guy's name was Okey Pack, O-K-E-Y-P-A-C-K, and he would sneak, he was a politician and he had a way with people, so he learned to talk the Japanese into giving him a little extra portion of rice every once in a while. So he would sneak that into him.
Oh my God!
He snapped him out of it. He. In fact, Jimmy wouldn't have made it if it hadn't been for him.
I bet you that's true. This is probably too strong a question, and you might not want to answer it. But did he want to live?
Oh yes,
he wanted to live.
Oh yes, he grew up on a farm, and he said that they studied the stars at night. They had a guy was in there who had majored in college in astrology. Astronomy, and
uh-huh.
he said that he would tell them about the stars at night and keep them up to date on as much as he could. Of course, they didn't hear anything about what was going on outside.
Right.
And he would keep them busy like that. He kept their minds busy, tried to. So he did a wonderful thing. I will never forget that guy. I don't know him, but I'll never forget him because he did such a good job keeping their minds sharp.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they had blood brothers. There were 10 in a group, and if one of them did something bad, all 10 of them were punished.
Mm-hmm.
So that forced them to sort of take care of each other, and they stuck together. I mean, they were every guy in his outfit after the war, every summer, as many mm-hmm. of them as could, would get together.
Oh, my goodness. I tell you, really,
together.
Honestly, really. Well, I'm sure you could go on forever, and you say you could write a book. I bet, and maybe we should do that someday. Maybe we should. You know, we have a really good ally to this organization. You met him very briefly one day. His name is Jay Wirtz. He's been to West Virginia one time, and he interviewed Woody Williams when Woody was on our board. Uh-huh. And he essentially does interviews of the World War II veterans, but they've faded so fast. And he's extremely stressed right now because he lost his publisher. But he's an excellent, excellent writer. I'm really so pleased that he loves this project.
Well, good.
And someday I'm going to give him your phone number, and maybe he can do an interview with you. I would love to record that and let him do the interview.
Okay.
Well, let's go back to how many children did you have, Ruth?
Two sons. And then I went back to school. I went back to college, went to the University of Charleston, which was Morris Harvey at that time.
Uh-huh.
Got my B.S. in business education, and then got my master's from Marshall University. And I taught school for 11 years and then was promoted to the State Department of Education as state supervisor of business education. Traveled the state and evaluated all the business programs in all the high schools in the state.
Right.
And retired in 1982. And I wanted to tell you one thing about the plant. One of the most fascinating things to me, and I think I told you about this before, was the heat treating unit. And it was that large building we were in. It was mm-hmm. the back part of the building we were in.
Mm-hmm.
And it had about 10 or 12 large furnaces.
Mm-hmm.
And they had those large steel plates that go on parts of the battleship.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, and these overhead cranes, they were the width of the building. And they would go up and down those bays with those steel plates. And they would put the steel plates in the furnaces and have the temperature just as high as, I don't remember now what the temperature was that they had them. But they were red hot when they came out of there, those plates were.
Mm-hmm.
And the cranes would pick those red hot plates up and take them down those bays, clanging those bells all the way so everybody would get out of the way.
Yeah.
Take those plates and drop them in a solution. And, you know, you could hear them sizzle. And there was a little odor to them, but that was to harden that steel, of course. But that, to me, was amazing. I mean, it was fascinating. I could just, at night when I was doing my checking, I would always be over there when they were taking a plate out, you know, because it was fascinating to see.
Well, now, you know, I truly want to know more about this. What is, they... Explain the process to me like you never even said it, and just tell me again as much as you can. What I want the public to know into the future is exactly what this process was, as best you can tell me. Just start again and just keep talking.
With the heat treating unit?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There were about 10 or 12 of the furnaces, and they would get these large steel plates, parts of the battleship. And they would pick them up with the crane. The cranes were the width of the building, and they were huge to me. And they would go down the bay and pick up put the steel plates in the furnace. And there would be furnace operators, and they would keep that temperature turned up just as high as they could. And it had to be kept at that temperature for so long, and that would get those plates red hot. And then
mm-hmm.
the cranes would come back. And they would pick those plates up, those red hot plates, and put them on, lift them on those cranes, and take them down. And they had a I don't know exactly what you would call it, like a bay or a bin or what,
mm-hmm.
some type of solution. And they
mm-hmm.
would drop those red hot plates in that solution. And in my mind, it was to harden that steel, and I guess that's what it was. But
mm-hmm.
then when they got that finished, then they would send them to the machine shop where they would be finished. And then sent to wherever they were supposed to be sent. But to me, that was one of the most fascinating things there. I watched them do the drill bits. I watched them drill the holes, you know, for the gun barrels and all that. I watched it all. But I believe the furnaces were the most fascinating to me because of the way they did that steel to get it hardened so that it would be strong and what, the way it was supposed to be. It was very, very interesting.
Well, now... I still am I can't get through my mind that they made ships there. What? Where did they? How did they transport those ships?
They did not make the ships. They made the parts for the ships.
And then they would transport it,
yes,
like maybe to the shipyards, Baltimore.
Yes.
And then they would essentially weld those pieces together.
That's exactly right.
I never, ever, ever knew that, and it is so simple. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty much sure, although not 100% positive, that they did the same thing in Weirton, because I've talked to the women who worked in the steel plants up there.
You're probably right.
And in other words, the coal mines were going 24/7 in order to provide the energy to make the steel.
Right.
How about that?
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that what they made over there at that South Charleston plant, one of the things that they made were armor-plated trucks. They were basically, you couldn't penetrate them with bullets and that kind of thing. But I didn't have any idea they made ships. And when you told me that, I couldn't envision it.
No.
You know, we just had a brief conversation about this one day.
No, it was a part for the ships.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Now, then the railroad was very close by. It actually runs through
That's right. It's right behind the heating plant. It was right there at the heating plant.
So then they would put these in railroad cars, and then take them to Norfolk or to Baltimore.
That's right, wherever. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. Amazing, isn't it?
Yes, it
is. Just amazing. It's just amazing, really.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth, we are asked by a lot of young women a question that I'm not sure that I relate to it. But they seem to feel, young women seem to feel that the women were looked down on for working in factories. Did you feel you were looked down on and because you wore slacks and worked in a factory?
Not at all, honey. Not at all. In fact, most of the people that I talked with and my associates were proud of the fact. I mean, we were doing something for the war effort. I mean, we were to be commended.
Right.
I didn't run into that at all. So.
What about feminine issues? Did you ever just have the cramps so bad you could barely do it, but you did it anyway?
But honey, I'm extremely healthy.
Yeah, I can tell that. That's for sure. But now, if a woman got pregnant, what happened, or did they get pregnant?
Well, not in the ones that I worked with, nobody did, because most of them, their husbands were overseas. You know, their husbands were in war. Most of them were.
Right.
And of course, they worried about their husbands. They were, they didn't know what was happening to them, so they were quite concerned about them all the time.
Right.
But some of them were working for the first time. They had never been out of, they had never done any outside work. And we had down here, it was a great group to work with. Everybody was so patriotic. We all knew why we were there. And even though it might seem like a little bit, still, and I was thinking, every Rosie has a story.
That's right. Exactly true. Every Rosie has a story. There's no doubt about it.
Many of them much more exciting than mine because...
No, they're not.
It didn't do anything really exciting, but to me it was exciting because I was young.
Yeah.
And it was very exciting. But
I'm glad
that I was able to do my little bit.
Yeah. Yep. And, the phrase that we use constantly is we pull better when we pull together.
That's exactly
And did you hear that phrase when you were in when you were working?
I really didn't.
Yeah,
because it seems we were just doing a job. We were there to do a job, and that's what we were doing. And we did pull together, but it was a very cooperative thing, and we all worked together, and we all had the same purpose, and it was just a very, very good, very nice feeling, very rewarding experience.
There's been a young man come to Morgantown recently. His name is Martin, M-A-A-R-T-E-N, I believe, Vossen, V-O-S-S-E-N. And he was assigned a grave of an American soldier. You know, when you look at a grave, it's more than a graveyard, I don't know what it, you would call it, but when you look at the gravestones from the drone that they used to make the film, it's miles and miles of American soldiers buried there, and, you know, with the white markers. And it's a well-done documentary film, and the first, one of the first scenes is his walking through this immense number of gravestones. They almost just look like white dots, and you don't realize at first what it is. And then he stops at a grave. And he was assigned a grave of a man named Jimmy, I'll think of it in a minute, who was from Morgantown. And from the age 13, he worried about who this person really was, not just to memorize the facts about him, which the students are told to do and are taught to do. And so he has just released a film that I went to see last weekend in Morgantown, and I saw it a month ago, and May 5th it was, in at the Embassy of the Netherlands in Washington. And the major thing I take from all of this, Ruth, is that it's not enough to tell about the battles. It's not enough to tell about the different boundaries that changed through the war, any of that stuff. That's the kind of history book stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's time in America, and it's time, I think, in the world for people to connect. Mm-hmm. And when you tell me this story, and especially about your husband, and I can feel the longing in you, and you know that he's gone. You know, you can't talk with him. You probably didn't. What did you get? Maybe a letter every, what, 3 or 4 months or what?
When he was in prison camp?
Yeah, or any time when he was gone.
Nothing at all.
Nothing?
No communications at all. And his mother and dad got, I think, 2 cards. I have those here. His mother gave them to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I still have them. And they're very, very, you can tell, you know, that he had to be careful what he said.
Yeah,
he didn't say anything really. I mean, he just keep safe and you know, tell all hello. I think one said tell all hello, and just very, very little. But they didn't hear from him at all, and I didn't either.
Yeah, so all those years really, and then you think about today we have instant communication, but we're not connecting to one another, and I'm hoping that somehow or another in this project, and I still don't know exactly how, that we'll get 4 or 5 roses. Buddy is superb beyond words.
Oh, yes.
Anna, whom we couldn't get a hold of, is excellent. You will love her. We have a Jewish woman up in Philadelphia who was essentially a high school student and during the first part of the war, and she finagled and pushed until they let her take drafting, and then she worked in the shipyards drafting ship parts for her mother made airplanes in the Baltimore shipyards. Mm-hmm. Now, we took this Jewish woman I'm telling you about and Anna to the Netherlands last year. We also took a woman who's slipping it quite seriously. And, you know, we have enough people like you, Ruth, left over here. You know, the women have died on a, most of the women in the film we made are no longer living.
Mm-hmm.
It really bothers me, but there's enough of people like you and Buddy and Hannah and June and 2 or 3 others that I really think somehow or another what we've got to do next is put a highlight on these women. And somehow, even though, you know, the media only gives you at the, you're very lucky if you get 40 seconds. We've got to put a face on who your Rosies are. Mm-hmm. And I'm really hoping that we can, all the work we've done here in the Kanawha Valley, that people will start to realize that we do have a model for the country. We're not just going in and getting interviews and leaving and saying goodbye and never see you again. We're working with Rosies like Buddy and Anna and June to, you know, to do something. And that's something we now have done since I talked with you last. That was before the park was open. We now have 18 different projects that we've done.
Uh-huh. Well, Anne, and, we had talked earlier about the way I understood it was a possibility of getting some unit in the middle school curriculum.
Yeah.
My granddaughter is the curriculum specialist in social studies and English.
Right.
For Kanawha County. And she said she would be happy to work with us on that.
She had
certain standards that she would have us incorporate into the units. But she said she was almost sure that she had teachers that would be really happy to, incorporate that into their curriculum. And I was just thinking, you know, if the youngsters would even just interview a Rosie, you know, part of their assignment would be to interview a Rosie or to have a Rosie come in and talk with them. Of course, you're doing that anyway.
Well, no, we're not doing it because I can't keep up with it, see? See, after this interview, let's say that we talk an hour and 10 minutes, and it will be for five times that to transcribe it. So basically, we're talking about 7 to 10 hours by the time we find the Rosies. It's really more than that.
Uh-huh.
The most important thing is, I think, that if we don't take this opportunity for the public to know the women, it doesn't matter what's on paper. It helps to have your own voice telling the story, but the most important thing is we want these young people to meet these women.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
that can happen.
Like we still go to schools.
Right, yeah. Right.
Betty, how many schools have you been in now? I think it's about 7 or 8, hasn't it been?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you've been to Boone County twice that I know of. You've been to St. Albans schools, what, maybe 3 times?
And to Hayes out here at the middle school.
Mm-hmm.
And, golly, I don't know. It's been quite a few. We went around different places.
Well, that's good.
I couldn't get you last week, but you have to put this on your calendar. And I don't know the date in June next year, Ruth, but Boy State had 400 and some boys. They take 2 of the best, the best leaders in every high school.
Both my boys went to Boy State.
Did they? I went to Girls State 108 years ago, I think. But, they love to have the Rosies. So you plan to go next year, and we'll make sure that you do that. Just ask a few last questions because I want to ask the kind of questions that I think people will want to know. You know, into the future.
My niece is calling from New York.
Okay. All right, my dear. Love you, and I'll talk to you soon, buddy.
I've enjoyed you, Ruth, very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Uh-huh. When you finished this work and the job was over and basically they just said, okay, girls, go home or whatever, ladies, go home. The war is over. Did you long for and yearn for the work again?
It was a kind of a mixed feeling. You know, you were glad the war was over, but you were going to miss the people you were working with because you had formed some real strong friendships.
Right.
And you were going to miss that, so it was sort of a mixed feeling that that was it. It was over. Carnegie Steel was out of here. They were back in Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh. Did you feel kind of left out, or did you miss the actual work itself?
I missed the work, yes, but I immediately, I don't know how long, maybe a week or two, I just went up to a carbide and just got right on, so I didn't have any trouble getting another job.
And what did you do at carbide?
At carbide, I went in as a secretary.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was my training when I was in high school, and
right.
Other than the work in the machine shop, that was mm-hmm. my basic training was secretary. So I was secretary. I had to a couple of doctors. I was very, very, very fortunate.
So basically, you were kind of like a personal secretary to a couple of PhDs. You mean? PhD chemist, is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really. No, you were fortunate. That's really true.
Yes, it was.
I bet you learned an incredible amount about the scientific process and
sure
all that.
I sure did, and I had to learn all those scientific terms.
Yeah.
That was difficult, to learn the spelling of all those terms, you know, because
right.
It certainly wasn't in my vocabulary at that time.
What did your husband do?
He was an electrician.
Oh, really?
At Carbide. Mm-hmm.
And where did he learn that?
He learned it on the job.
So Carbide hired veterans and trained them?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
OJT.
Mm-hmm.
How about that? Well, now, how did you get interested in business? So since you essentially were the person in the state of West Virginia who was responsible for teaching business classes, how did you get interested in business? Was that mostly because business at that time was defined mostly as secretarial?
Secretarial. It was mostly secretarial, uh-huh. And, you know, there's usually a person that influences you. You have an influential person in your life. And
right.
The person who taught business at Hamlin High School, Ruby Miller was her name,
mm-hmm.
and she was in a wheelchair. But
mm-hmm.
she was a fantastic business teacher. So she influenced me. I mean, I thought, this is something that she is really, she's good at it. She loves it, and she's really good at it. And she taught practical things about being a secretary, other than just typing in shorthand and office machine. She taught a lot of, you know, work ethic and all that kind of stuff that went along with it. And she was a good example. And she's the one influenced me to go into business.
I'll bet that. Do you know anything about what happened to her?
I followed her as long as she lived, honey. I stayed in touch with her, and I was Business Educator of the Year in 1980,
mm-hmm.
and she wrote me a letter then and told me how proud she was of me, and she was just my idol.
Well, I am so glad to hear that. You know, I've always been awkward with my hands, and I love fine things, and by that I mean, you know, delicate things, and I can fiddle with them and all that, but I've never been smooth with my hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always felt that if I were better with my hands, I would have been a musician, because I hear music, but I've never learned an instrument, and I never learned an instrument because I couldn't do anything with my hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very, very bad at typing in high school. It's the one class that I made a bad grade in. I don't remember what it was. And so if it hadn't been for computers, I would probably not ever have done this project, because I can't stand the thought of typing, making 5 mistakes, and erasing it page after page.
Mm-hmm. Now, all you got to do is backspace.
I mean, really, drove me nuts. Tell me about backspacing. What was that?
That's all you got to do with the computer to make correct.
Oh, yeah,
mistakes.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. In any event, I never wanted to be a secretary, because I never wanted. I couldn't. I literally am awkward with my hands. It's almost like I'm spastic in a way. You know, I can tell you right now that I put my hands on the keys and they'll be on. I put Velcro on the keyboard in order to know where my fingers are, because I literally can't figure out where the keys are.
Well,
it's just something doesn't really connect with me this way. But I think it's so fascinating that I've always been really, really intrigued by women who are really, really good secretaries. There is a serious amount of management and organizational and logical and plain good business practice that goes into being a good secretary.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people, when we first started doing this project, if I would interview somebody who was an office worker, they'd say, no, that's not a rose there. And say, oh, yes, it is. I mean, the work that you all did in offices, I remember my mother being in a secretarial pool, and there were 18 women in one room, and it just about drove her nuts. But I can't imagine counting on a typewriter with 18 women in one room. And
that would be difficult.
Yeah, really, really.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is going to happen now in terms of education? You're an educator, Ruth. We've come full circle, or I don't know what the word, that's not the way it is. We've come from being so very concerned that everybody get an education, and we revered education when I grew up. We just revered it. And now we've come to the point where so many people are educated that we aren't achieving as a society. What do you think is happening in America today?
Well, I think a lot of times we put too much emphasis on the fact that everybody's not going to college and everybody's not going to college. So I'm pretty much in, well, I believe that they need to have some skill training also, because call it vocational education or technical education or whatever, but there are an awful lot of our young people that do not want to go to college for one reason or another. So many of them go to college and they major in a field that they never work in. They're not interested in that field. So I'm pretty much, I like the technical colleges, and I like to see the young people who aren't going to go on to college. I like to see them get into something that they can actually do. Call it
newspaper
work, or call it skill work, or call it technical work, whatever you want. But I think there are just an awful lot that do not need to follow the college. They can follow the college curriculum, but have something else in mind also.
Well, now, we have a man on our board since talking with you, and then as many changes as I've said, but one of our board members is named Michael Kindred, and he's principal of a vo-tech school in Kentucky. And he called me because he wanted to know how to attract women into vo-tech and how to retain them. Sometimes they'll start, but he seems to think that he can't figure out if it's just a woman's streak and they don't want to do hands-on stuff, or if it's, you know, the image or of it being masculine or whatever. But he and I have talked many, many times about how we feel that the Rosie the Riveter movement should involve people literally doing something with their hands when possible.
Oh, I agree 100%. And if you haven't been to this Bridgemont Technical College out here on the
Carpenter, I haven't.
Oh, honey, go, because it is fantastic.
Is that right?
Yes. And if young ladies would see the opportunities there in the chemical field and in various fields, I think they would be very, very much impressed with it.
Is that right?
Yes.
Hmm.
And welding, I have never, ever, ever been interested in welding. But I went through that welding I didn't go through the program, but I went through the introduction to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic. You have like headphones that you put on, and you have a little stylus, and you follow the blueprint that they give you. And you can follow that blueprint, and you can take your little stylus, and you can pinpoint where the problem is. You can troubleshoot from right there, just sitting in your chair right there. It's amazing.
Interesting. I honestly didn't know that. Tell me this, since Cole has gone from West Virginia for 100,000 reasons, what do you think can replace coal for West Virginia? Do you think that we could become a technical, and by that I'm talking about hands-on type of work again?
Yes.
Or do you, and how would you do that?
Well, now they have programs out here at Bridgemont. I'm interested in that right now because that's, I did a tour of it, and it was just so interesting to me. But they have all kinds of programs out there. Earn as you learn. You can get a job in a plant like Matrix, which is out here on the hill in the technical center, or one of the other plants, and you can get trained. You can be on their payroll, and you can be learning at the same time.
Is that right?
After you complete the program, then you stay with them. You know, you're working for them. You've been working for them. And it's good. It's very, very good. And it's for women as well as men.
Really? Uh-huh. Well, now, your husband was very ill for a long time. Was he ill? He never was really healthy again,
no,
was
he? Not.
Uh-uh. He was not.
But we had a good life because we made the very most out of it, you know.
And did he know that he probably would die early?
I don't really think he thought about it because he'd been through so much.
Yeah.
That I don't think he thought a whole lot about it.
And he loved the church.
He died at 36.
He loved being a father.
Yes, yes. He didn't have much patience, but he loved them.
Yeah.
But he wasn't very patient. But
I'm really.
You know, I could understand that.
How old was he when he died?
76.
Oh, I thought he was younger than that.
No, he was 76 when he died.
How old are you now, Ruth?
93.
I'm sorry, tell me again, 93?
Uh-huh.
Is that right? My gosh. You know, I've always worked circles around, even when I was in Boston, and I'd hire these students from Harvard or MIT or whatever, and they can't keep up with me. And I have slowed down a lot in the last 6 months. But, you know, once you're wired to look for how things work and how they fit together, it's almost as though it's its own reality. And many, many times I'll try to tell people what this project is about, and they get lost so quick because they want to hear just one thing. They want to know that you're naming bridges, but they don't want to know that you're naming buildings and bridges and rooms and meeting with allied nations and, hanging bluebird houses that mean hope and planting dogwood trees. I mean, they just can't keep up with it.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But when it really comes down to it, I think what's going to happen is if we can lay out for different communities, now these are the things that we have done, and most of these require some hands-on work. You decide what you want to do, and you do it a whole lot better than we have done it. You don't say that we're the giant. Say that we're the little molehill that you can stand on top of and see a little bit farther.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the hands-on stuff, I'm just really into it. I believe that this country really needs to show that we can do things together, and that the more hands-on it is, the better.
I agree. There's nothing like the hands-on.
Nothing like it, really.
That's right.
I know you disappeared on us for several years. Are you interested in meeting with some new Rosies that you've never met before?
Yes, I don't do a lot of driving, Ann.
Yeah.
I drive to my church, and I drive to Kroger's, and I drive down to Community Center, and I drive to Eastern Star meetings when I go, and AARP meetings, just locally, but I don't do much driving out.
And I understand that. Yeah, I understand that. Well, you know, that's the same with everybody, and since I talked with you last, I quit driving. I quit driving somewhere about 2000 and... I believe 11, something like that, maybe 12. It was 2012.
Uh-huh.
And, that sure does limit your scope, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes,
but
it does.
Guess what? We're doing it anyway. We're going to do it. We're wired to do it, Ruth. We're just wired, you know?
That's what I thought about visiting the schools, you know. I could locally, but I couldn't visit very many, you know,
yeah.
Out of the area.
Yeah, we'll work on that. Well, I can't tell you how glad I am to be back in touch with you. And the way we're going to be doing this is we'll get somebody to transcribe the interview. It'll take probably, I'd say, 5 hours to transcribe it. I'm not promising anybody anything until after Labor Day because we have an event scheduled on Labor Day.
Well, of course, if there's anything that's said that doesn't sound right, you'll take that out, won't you?
I'm not sure. No, I won't do that. Actually, I think the real fun thing is the spontaneity of you ladies. I mean, you know, when on the rare occasion when somebody will be snippy or maybe even curse a little bit, I just say to him, now, remember, you're being recorded. And that's the way it is, because this is part of history. My dear, I love you so much, and I'm so glad to be in touch with you, back in touch with you, Ruth. I really am. I have to admit that there are times in West Virginia here that I starve for, and especially since I don't drive anymore, I starve for more people to understand what I'm doing and why it's important.
Uh-huh.
And I love being with the Rosie.
I really admire you and for the work you're doing, because I think it's wonderful.
We're going to do it. We're just going to do it. And I have to get you to meet Anna and some other people. We are going to be going to D.C. in the next couple of weeks, and but I'll be in touch with you about any kind of details about any of that stuff soon.
Okay.
And I've got a young man who's coming. He just parked. He's my neighbor. And he's got a girlfriend. He's bringing her a great big bouquet of beautiful yellow flowers. So.
Oh, how nice. How nice.
That's a nice way to end this meeting, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Anyway, I love you, Ruth. I'm really, really glad we're back in touch. And I'm very touched by your story about your husband. And we do need to make sure that the stories that you heard from your husband are preserved, because the women know the sorrow of war. In some ways, I think they know it better than men, because they basically have to shoulder it when the men can't. And it's a different thing. It's not like him threatening your life, but it's extremely important that we realize that if women aren't there to essentially soften the blow, then it probably is not going to be a very healthy society if women are not able to be respected for what they do best, which is to comfort and love, and to at times make some tough decisions.
Yep.
All right, my dear. Thank you so much. I love you, and I'll be talking to you soon.
Okay, Ann.
Bye now.
Rick.